load resistor. But in the case of a Wilkinson hybrid, where the load resistor is 100 ohm completely floating on both ends, and if you want to make that with low reactance and good heat sinking, that's an extremely difficult engineering effort as I see it. So making good dummy loads at high power for a quadrature hybrid, easy. For a Wilkinson hybrid, I think it's hard. OUR, K2LAW. No, it did. I was going to be a handful of bad ones. actually, in the big transmitter, we've also got 50 ohm. This is constructed in the same way as the 100 ohm resistors. 50 ohm resistors constructed in the same way as the 100 ohm resistors. Basically, if you were looking at a rectangular power transistor, it looks like that, except it has two loops coming out of the side of it, and the bottom of it, of course, is heat sink. And then there's a little slab of beryllium oxide, then there's a resistor, and then there's another slab of beryllium oxide. And they're very low reactance. They're quite amazing. Although I was thrown for a loop, and I was looking at one particular design, which is actually nichrome wire. That really made me scratch my head a bit. You could build a nichrome wire, very low reactance resistor, if you had the exact right kind of layout. The helical wound, the helix that's inside of a traveling wave tube, for instance, is a pure 50 ohm transmission line, even though it's very distributed. Okay, we really got to move on to our list. Fascinating stuff. Joe, W2RYY, we better grab you in a hurry before somebody else comes along. K2RYW, go ahead, Joe. Maybe Joe got called away, and maybe he'll come back later, which he sometimes does. We'll go over to Sam right now. KC1, I think it is, SAM. K2RAW. Wait a minute now. I think the next person is, I think it's KC1, SAM. Go ahead, Sam. K2RAW.
Yeah, I believe it's me, KC1, SCRO. Mike, I think I got a question for you. Houston country has two antennas. One last week was the horizontal loop you were talking about, and it was pretty cut and dry. It's horizontal and polarized. You went through quite a bit of detail about it, and I understand that. Last month, QST had a horizontal antenna. I know you get the magazine, so I won't bore you with the details. I'm sure you saw it. It's about a 19.5-inch square piece of aluminum. Horizontally, on top of a great for a mobile antenna, on top of a car, but it's vertically polarized. And I wonder if you can tell me why that one would be vertical, whereas the loop would be horizontal. Back over to you.
Yeah, when you do come back to us, Sam, give us a little bit more audio. Your audio was a few dB lower than it could be, and the signal a tiny bit weak. But we heard every word, not to worry. The square-like antenna that you put on top of the sheet metal of a car really is a patch antenna. You go to any of the websites and Google the word patch, P-A-T-C-H antenna, or look at the appropriate chapter of Antenna Engineering Handbook, you get a little bit more of a clue as to why it is vertically polarized. The patch itself usually is a half wavelength in at least one of its dimensions, if not two of the dimensions. At one instant of time, you could say the bottom line of the patch is positive and the upper line of the square patch is negative at that instant, operating against a ground plane. And so that patch creates a vertically polarized, very strong E-field above that ground plane, the hunk of sheet metal. In the case of a horizontal loop, where you take the plane of a loop antenna and lay it parallel to the ground, the current is flowing in the perimeter of that structure. It's flowing around the structure. The direction the current flows and the instantaneous E-field across that conductor is what tends to give you the polarity. I know that's not completely pleasing as an answer. And by the way, 2 weeks ago I made one hell of an error. Let me drop it. I was predicting that a loop antenna where the plane of the loop is parallel to the ground would make a nevus antenna, that it would radiate the signal straight up and down. Absolutely not true. I was wrong on that one. The loop antenna does create a very strong H-field component in the axis of the loop. In other words, if the loop was a wheel, so to speak, and you had an axle going through the middle of it, your H-field is along that axis. And in order to radiate a vertically, a nevus signal near incident vertical sky wave, you know what I mean, a signal straight up, you'd be trying to radiate a signal parallel to that H-field vector component. And a real TEM wave, transverse electromagnetic wave, the receiver must see the E-field and the H-field at right angles to each other, when the H-field vector is pointed directly in the direction you want to transmit, it's the equivalent to trying to transmit a signal off the end of a dipole. Your E-field in that case is aimed straight at the source as opposed to being at right angles to it. Real TEM wave, the E-field vector and the H-field component must be at right angles to the direction of propagation. So the bottom line of all this is that a loop antenna parallel to the ground gives you a beautiful null up and down, but gives you a horizontally polarized signal around the perimeter. I had that kind of mixed up last week. But the way the current flows in the loop determines its polarization. And in the case of a patch antenna, you've got a very strong E-field above and below that ground plane, which makes it vertically polarized. Maybe that helps a little bit. Over to you, Sam. KC1SAM with a little more audio. K2IW on TechNet. I'll wait for the beeps.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. I just pumped the audio up a little bit. You can let me know when I give it back to you if it sounds better. It's just not intuitive when you look at that. That's why I had a trouble grasping it. The horizontal polarization of a loop, you kind of can feel that, you know what I'm saying? But I did not see this as a vertical. And I still quite don't get it. I will look up patch antenna and read some about it. When you think vertical, you're thinking height. Like you wonder how high above it would be equivalent to and so forth. But I do have something to read now. I'll look up patch, and I kind of get the feel for it, but not very, very well. I have to do some reading. So I appreciate you getting back to me. this is the KC1, the Sarah Alpha Mike, back over to you. And is my audio a little bit better now? K2RIW?
Your audio is just about perfect, Sam, so leave it there. It's a little bit hard to believe that there's a significant vertically polarized E-field when that particular dimension of this patch antenna is such a small dimension. In some cases, that patch may have a dielectric thickness. The patch, by the way, is quite often a square chunk of conductor, half inch on the side. If you're looking at a top view, picture a square of conductor, like copper sheet, which is half wavelength wide, half wavelength high. And when you're looking at a top view at one instant of time, the upper linear edge all becomes positively polarized, polarity, and the negative, and the bottom line, horizontal line, is edge is a negative at that instant of the half wave. And down the center, horizontal line through the center, it would be the neutral voltage point. That gives you some idea of what the instantaneous voltage looks like top view. When you look at it edge view, if you're looking from the edge of that bottom horizontal line, you see a huge amount of voltage per meter. There may only be an eighth inch, quarter inch of thickness to it, and you got lots of volts across it. And so it does radiate a nearly purely vertically polarized signal, which I'm trying to think now, what is the pattern like? The pattern is very much similar to a dipole, except that me think now, where the signal is maximum is maybe displaced 90 degrees from a real dipole. It's an unusual antenna. It's hard to believe that these patch antennas, let me drop them. These patch antennas can be made so conformal. If you've got a cylindrical object like a surface-to-air missile, a rocket, and you've got this tubular area along the side of the rocket, and you wrap a piece of sheet metal around the rocket on top of the sheet metal of the rocket itself with a dielectric spacer in between, that can be made into a patch antenna which has a curved surface to it. The radiation pattern's a little bit more complicated, but that can be an extremely efficient antenna that has very little wind load. You can do the same thing with the leading edge of an airplane. You can put a patch antenna there, or the vertical stabilizer of an airplane. You can put a patch antenna on that sheet metal. So patch antennas, among the amateur radio environment, they're very rare. But you read about patch antennas, they're fairly exotic, and once you start experimenting with them, by building them out of sheet copper and sheets of dielectric material, plexiglass, for instance, among other things, and you're doing the testing with a vector network analyzer, you'd be amazed how easy it is to make one of these antennas. It's a little bit on the narrowband side. Let me drop. When you read the appropriate chapter, you read the appropriate chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, you'll find out that the bandwidth of the antenna is primarily due to the thickness of the dielectric material. You can make the dielectric material that the sheet metal is sitting on top of, and that in turn is sitting on top of a larger ground plane. You could make that out of very thin material, and it becomes an extremely high Q narrow band antenna. So that thickness determines the bandwidth. But it's the E field across that dielectric material that creates the vertical polarization of the signal that's radiated from it. And it radiates in the plane. The majority of the radiation is, I think it's in the plane of the ground plane. And does it radiate? I think it has somewhat of a null at right angles to that. You know, normal to the antenna, I think there's a bit of a null in the pattern. I'll have to do some checking on that one. But I built quite a few of these a few years ago with a good vector network analyzer and sheets of copper. I was doing this at a 900 megs, where it's the sizes are just a small number of inches, if you know what I mean, and you can easily manipulate it. And you can tune it by holding a piece of copper tape on the end of a wooden stick, and you put it near those gaps around the perimeter, and you'll see the way the tuning works. So good luck with that research, Sam. KC1SAM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2IS, query.
Yeah, I'll clear in a second. I appreciate you coming back to me on it. I'll look more into it. It's ideal to me because it's like a perfect antenna to put on top of my Suburban. And no one would know it's there. So I'll look into it more, but I like the idea of it. Hey, I appreciate it, and I'll give it back to you, Dick, and you have someone else wanting to jump in. This would be KC1 SAM clear. Thank you again.
Yeah, there's lots of ways of putting a hidden antenna onto an automobile. A patch antenna is one very good way, and slot antennas are the other way, where with proper installation, you'll never know the antenna is there. So plainclothes cars can be built that way. The person who said query, blank, 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 AS, give me your full set of call letters and your name, and go ahead with your query. K2RIW in the TechNet, my name is Dick.
This is AC2IS, Bill. So I think you just said that a patch antenna radiates a signal in the plane of the patch, but I did not think that was the case. I thought that a patch antenna radiated sort of perpendicular to the plane of the antenna. Totally be wrong there. But then also you said, I think you use a plastic, like maybe acrylic, as a dielectric, that might make it good dielectric, and the thicker the dielectric, the higher the Q. So I'm guessing that the thickness of the dielectric does not relate to the frequency that you're transmitting on, but basically the size of the patch does. And then where would you feed the signal into this patch? Would you be trying to feed it from the center or from an edge, AC to IF?
Does the patch antenna radiate normal to the patch? Was your first, one of your early questions. And I thought it might be nulled in that direction. I could be wrong. I think it does radiate in that direction. I'm beginning to think that the patch antenna creates a hemisphere of radiation above the ground plane. The ground plane itself could be an infinite sheet of metal, in which case it would only radiate in the upper hemisphere. And so, is the signal stronger normal or in the plane? And it could very well be strong in the normal. You might be right on that one, Bill. I wasn't studying the antenna pattern, I was only studying the radiation resonance conditions. As you change the thickness of the dielectric, it has an extremely minor effect on the frequency tuning of the antenna. You're absolutely right. As long as the square of metal in at least one of its dimensions is a resonant length, when you include the dielectric constant of the of the insulating material. The insulating material is between the ground plane and the actual patch radiator. Let me drop that. Propagation-wise, that is a kind of microstrip. So the velocity factor of microstrip constructed with that thickness of dielectric material of that particular dielectric constant determines your velocity factor and therefore the size of the patch. So the patch itself is a resonant half wavelength in the material that's being used for the dielectric. The dielectric material, I've used mylar, plexiglass, polycarbonate. I'm trying to get some of the other materials I've used. There's lots of fairly low loss dielectric materials that will serve very well as the spacer between the radiator and the ground plane. You feed a patch. There's a bunch of different ways you can feed it. But if you fed the outer edge of the patch, you'd be feeding something like 1,000 ohm impedance. Let me drop it. Which would be kind of difficult. If you move your feed point from the outer edge and you start moving it closer and closer to the center, the impedance goes down by, I believe it's a square law of distance. So there is a magic distance from the center where you put a probe through the dielectric material. Your connector, in the most convenient way, the connector is on the bottom side of the ground plane sheet metal. The center conductor goes through that sheet metal of the ground plane without making contact to it, through the dielectric material, and makes electrical contact to a point on the patch. There's a magic position away from the center of the patch, which is the so-called 50 ohm point at your particular resonant frequency. That's one of the ways of feeding it. That's a somewhat non-symmetric way, but it works like a charm. You don't have to feed it with two symmetric probes, so to speak. A lot of people think you do. That's one of many ways of feeding the patch, but that's one of the very popular ways. You could feed it from the outer perimeter, and it's sometimes done with a piece of exotic microstrip, but you have to do some pretty fancy impedance matching, because at that point of the outer perimeter of the patch, the impedance is something like 1,000 ohms. AC2IS, K2IW, go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, AC2IS here. Is the patch antenna typically a square, or is it usually circular? AC2IS.
Doesn't have to be square. As long, you could make it as a rectangle, as long as it is a half wavelength electronically in the one dimension. which could be the long dimension. You could, if you want to, make it as a not completely square, a kind of a rectangle where vertically is resonant at one frequency and horizontally, well, I'm top view, I'm talking top view now, top view vertically is resonant at one frequency, horizontally is resonant at a slightly different frequency, and you feed it at the right point. It'll give you circular polarization because of the difference in those two resonant frequencies. So it's got to be a half wavelength electronically in at least one dimension. Now, there's nothing magic about the shape of the radiator. It can be oval, circular, square. In some cases, you could even make it a triangle. It'll have a more exotic radiation pattern. But as long as it is electronically resonant in one dimension, it will act as a patch antenna. It's a little bit more difficult to calculate the resonant diameter if you make it a circle. And if you do make it a circle, you could feed it with two separate probes that are carefully mounted so that with the right kind of a hybrid feeding it, it would make beautiful circular polarization. And that is sometimes used as a kind of a feed horn for a parabolic dish antenna. And there's the evidence we were looking for. Let me drop that. The fact that a patch antenna is often used as a feed horn for a parabolic dish antenna is a pretty strong piece of evidence that it does have a major radiation lobe normal to the sheet metal of the patch and normal to the ground plane. So where I had a doubt about that before, that is the major location of the radiation. And so now your mind says, gee, the voltage that's appearing across the patch in its resonant length is acting like a dipole. It is a kind of dipole operating against a ground plane. Maybe that makes it a little bit more clear, Bill. I haven't been working on these patches now for quite a few years, as you can tell. I'm re-deriving what I used to be doing. AC2IS, K2IW, the TechNet.
Yeah, thanks for all that, Dick. You said that one of the dimensions, I'm going to assume, you know, typically patch antennas now are square. It seems like circular has benefits for certain specific cases, but most cases you're going to want your patch antenna to be square. You said that one side, one length of the patch antenna has to be a half wave of your resonant frequency. When you mentioned other antennas, especially cut out of sheet metal for slot antennas and things like that, that sort of the path around the slot had to be your wavelength, right? So if the slot that you cut got to be very wide, you'd end up shortening the length of your slot in order to make it resonate at your given frequency. It sounds like you're saying that's not the case here with the patch antenna, and I was wondering why. AC2IS.
Yeah, we created some confusion now between loop antennas, slot antennas, and patch antennas. In case of a loop antenna, the majority of the current is flowing in the sheet metal, in the tubing of the loop, if it's a one-turn loop antenna. In the case of a patch antenna, when you look at the patch from the normal direction, top view, so to speak, assume I've got a square patch in front of me, and the upper horizontal edge of the patch at one instant in time, almost all of that is positively polarized, positive voltage on it. At that same instant, the bottom horizontal edge will be negative voltage on that half cycle. So it's like a very fat dipole. And that dimension up and down would have to be, in my example, it would have to be half wavelength in the dielectric material viewed as a piece of microstrip. In the case of a slot antenna, you're now comparing that to a loop, and that's a wrong comparison. you're assuming the current flows around the perimeter of the slot. It does not. Let me drop. If you're cutting a slot in a very large piece of sheet metal, the length of the slot will be very close to a half wavelength. As you make the slot wider and wider, the bandwidth increases, the impedance changes in a slightly complicated way, but the length stays almost the same. The instantaneous, if I've got a large sheet of metal in front of me and I've got a horizontal slot cut in it, at one instant of time, the center of the slot, the upper edge will be positive, the lower edge will be negative. A slot antenna has the exact same radiation pattern as a dipole, except horizontal polarization becomes vertical polarization. That horizontal slot that I just described, I've got my piece of sheet metal perpendicular to the ground, I'm looking at it flat on, so to speak, and I've got this horizontal slot cut in it. That is a purely vertically polarized antenna. It'll radiate in both directions from the slot, toward me and away from me, so to speak, if you don't do something to shield the back end of it. And the instantaneous voltage across the slot is a maximum voltage in the center of the slot, the upper portion, the upper edge is positive, the lower edge is negative. On this half cycle, the next half cycle, it reverses. You feed energy across the slot by putting a piece of semi-rigid coax cable at some particular position away from center, but not near a shorted edge, and you have the shield of the semi-rigid cable connected to the lower edge of the slot. The center conductor goes across the gap and touches the upper edge, and you choose the right position away from the shorted ends, but not in the center. In the center, it's 1,000 ohms. As you go to the shorted edge where you mount your piece of semi-rigid cable, the impedance gets lower and lower. And so there's a magic position where it'll give you a 50 ohm impedance at your favorite frequency.
Repeater, timeout.
But as you make the width of the slot wider and wider, it has an extremely minor effect on the resonant frequency. The bandwidth increases as you do that. And so now, how far can you carry that? Well, there is a kind of square-looking driven element of a Yagi antenna, which is called a skeleton slot, depending on how you use it. So you can carry it to a ridiculous extreme, as you can tell. So you thought the current is flowing around the perimeter of a slot. Not quite. Now, you do get very high current flowing at the two short circuit ends. You get very little current in the middle of the slot. You get very high voltage in the center of the slot. AC2IS, K2IW, are you starting to get the picture as to how that antenna works, Bill?
I think so. Is there an easy place to look up the distance for your feed point? I guess, I'm not sure from what you said, but I'm thinking it would be a certain proportion from the between the center and the edge where you get 50 ohms, or is that not the case? AC2IS.
Slot antennas are also rarely used by amateurs because they don't quite understand them. It looks like a short circuit. It looks like it shouldn't do anything. Assume now that my slot at 900 megacycles is 4.5 inches long. That's approximately the right inch, the right dimension. So I've got a sheet of metal, I've got a horizontal slot on my sheet of metal, 4.5 inches long, and maybe I've got an eighth of an inch or a 16th of an inch of actual width of the slot. In the center of that 4.5 inches, if I put my semi-rigid coax, bridging that gap, shield connecting the lower edge of the slot, center conductor connecting the upper edge, I probably have about 1,000 ohm impedance. As I take that piece of semi-rigid cable with the same method of construction of attachment, but I slide it to the right or to the left, I'm sliding it along the 4.5 inch dimension. As I approach the outer edge of the slot, the impedance goes down and eventually becomes essentially 0 ohm. So there's a magic position, which if you're experimenting with the right kind of an antenna analyzer, a vector network analyzer, antenna analyzer, standing wave ratio bridge or whatever, you will very rapidly find the position where the piece of cable goes across the slot to give you the 50 ohm impedance at your center frequency. So it doesn't take very many experiments to find it. You don't have to calculate it. The actual calculation would probably be a really crazy equation. Let me drop it. By the way, there's a fairly strong correlation between a slot antenna and the open end of a piece of waveguide. The actual voltage and currents have a strong correlation. If I'm looking normal to a slot antenna, and if I'm looking down a piece of waveguide, the piece of waveguide fed in the dominant mode, the center of the upper edge, at one instant, is my waveguide, by the way, is laying on the bench with the major dimension parallel to the bench. That's the and the shortest dimension is perpendicular to the bench. That's the way my waveguide is laying. That has a strong correlation with the piece of with the slot antenna I've been describing. At one instant of time, the upper edge of the waveguide is positive, the lower edge of the waveguide is negative at one instant of time. And the signal is going down the waveguide. The actual vector of propagation of the signal is zigzagging left and right. It's bouncing off the vertical short walls. But the way the signal goes down a waveguide and the way the signal arranges itself in the slot antenna have a strong correlation. AC2IS, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, now we're talking slot antennas and waveguide antennas, but we're not talking about patches. My question was, would the feed point need to be a certain proportion between the center of the patch and the edge of the patch, but are the answers somewhat the same for a slot antenna as for a patch antenna? If I figure out where my 50 ohm feed point is on a slot antenna, can I use that information to determine where my feed point needs to be on a patch antenna?
I'm pretty sure the answer is no. In both cases, okay, in the case of a slot antenna, if you put your transmission line across the slot in the center of the slot, if it's a 4.5-inch long slot, and at the 2.25 inches from each end, if I put my cable there, the center of the slot, I'm going to see 1,000 ohms. As I go toward the outer edge of the slot, the impedance gets lower and lower. In the case of a patch antenna, if I feed the outer edge, it's again 1,000 ohm impedance, and as I move my feed point closer and closer to the center of the patch, the impedance gets lower and lower. If you feed at the exact center, it would really be resonating at twice the frequency, if you know what I mean. It would be running in a different mode of operation. So comparing a patch and a slot is a difficult comparison. Comparing a patch and waveguide is a little bit easier. You could, by the way, put a slot antenna across the open end of a piece of waveguide, and you could feed the slot that way if you wanted to. Let me think about that. Yes, you could make that work. You need some impedance matching between the two, but it gives you a little bit of an idea of the correlation between waveguide and slot. And your next question is going to be, could I use a piece of waveguide to feed a patch antenna? And the answer is that's a difficult transition. That would be a very difficult transition. That may help a little bit. AC2IS, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is AC2IS. I'm thinking this will be my final question on this topic. But finding the feed point for a patch antenna seems to be less trivial experimentally. So is there a good resource or a good, I suppose I should just be doing a web search, right, on patch antennas, and feed points for them to figure out, say, if I'm going to build a dielectric, I'd have to be cutting a square that's going to be about the dimensions of my ground plane and my radiator. Ground plane and radiator, I think, are going to be the same sizes. But I'm going to want to put a hole in the dielectric where I want my feed point to be. So when I start building that dielectric, how do I know in advance where I want that hole to be, or is there maybe an easier way to do this experimentally than what I'm thinking of? AC2IS.
In most cases, Bill, the ground plane sheet metal on a patch antenna is considerably larger than the radiator portion of the patch. The ground plane is almost always larger. If you made the two identical in size, that's not a patch antenna anymore. It's got a name, I can't think of the name. It's a different antenna. The size wouldn't be too different. The resonant frequency wouldn't be too different. But it's a different antenna. So most patch antennas, the ground plane is considerably larger than the radiator. You do the calculation assuming the ground plane is infinity. If you go to the patch antenna section of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, or if you Google the word patch antenna, guarantee you'll find quite a few articles that will give you suggestions as to where you mount the feed point. When you actually do it experimentally, you're going to end up drilling a couple of holes for the ground plane and a couple of experiments. Let me drop. However, if the very first place you choose to drill a hole through the ground plane to mount your connector that feeds the signal into the patch, and you choose a point that's, let me pick a number, halfway between center and the lower edge, and you end up with 150 ohm impedance, and you know that the impedance changes, that the signal flowing across the patch follows a sine wave of amplitude, where I said sine wave, let me think about that. Maybe I better call it a cosine wave. You get maximum voltage on the lower edge, zero in the center, maximum voltage opposite polarity on the upper edge. I guess I could call that a sine wave shifted 90 degrees in phase. It's a cosine wave. So once you know the voltage distribution and you know the impedance you've just measured, you can now make a prediction as to what the voltage will be at a slightly different position. And voltage squared gives you impedance, so you can make a very good prediction. After one measurement, if you didn't use a good reference that tells you where to put the connector, after one measurement, knowing the voltage distribution across the patch, your very next guess, you're going to be within 95% accuracy, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Now, if I'm going to have a quote-unquote infinite ground plane, I'm going to put a hole in it at one point. I'm going to put a hole in my dielectric at one point. So if I'm going to be experimenting, I should have the radiator somehow be mounted in a way where it could slide along the feed point. I could shift that until I find my 50 ohm, my point at which I can feed it at 50 ohms. And if I make whatever is holding my radiator also out of acrylic, that's a dielectric material, do I have to worry about that interfering with the signal? Maybe not. But maybe I should be some other kind of material that's not going to interfere with us. That's it. AC2IS.
The methods of construction that you just described will work. People usually make the dielectric material identical in size to the radiator. And the sheet metal, you assume the ground plane goes to infinity. At least large enough to be well beyond resonant size, so to speak, at the frequency of operation. As I said, the dielectric material usually is the same size as the radiator. There's nothing magic about that. The dielectric material could be larger than the radiator. It'll make you a slightly difference in tuning. As you make the dielectric material slightly larger than the radiator, you'll be creating a little bit of extra capacitance at the perimeter, and the center frequency of the radiator will move slightly downward. And now, as far as these multiple holes you described, you could cut a thin slot through the dielectric material and a thin slot along the candidate locations for the feed point, and that slot, as long as it's not a resonant length, would have no effect, and now you'd be able to easily slide the radiator and re-solder it, so to speak, in order to find the 50 ohm position. Slide radiator and slide dielectric material. So there's ways you could drill all the holes ahead of time by making an appropriate slot, but if you use the right reference, it'll tell you where to mount all these things as I see it. Let me think now. Yeah. Reference data for radio engineers doesn't have it. Antenna engineering handbook's got it. You Google the word slot antenna build, you'll find quite a number of articles on it. But this is like the loop antenna. Loop antenna, I think only a couple of percent of the hams have ever used a loop. An even smaller percentage of hams have ever used a slot antenna.
Repeater, timeout.
Slot antenna of the kind we're talking about. And the reason for that is not that it's a low-performance antenna. It's the fact that people don't understand it. As you can tell, the steps we've had to go to in order to describe where the voltage flows on a slot antenna. The current does not flow around the perimeter. It's not the same method of resonance as you get with a loop antenna. A slot is not a loop. They are very different. Any final questions, Eric? Here we go. Bill, AC2IS, K2IW, the TechNet.
That's it for me on this topic. AC2IS.
Hey, you asked some pretty good questions, Bill, which is helping people who are listening to understand these exotic antennas, loops and slots, and waveguides and so on. The way it's taught in the school gives you a huge number of equations that you have to memorize, and you don't know what the hell is going on inside those equations. Talk to somebody who's had a true apprenticeship in an antenna engineering department of a good company, and he's got a whole bunch of rules of thumb that work for him. He knows how to cut the slot, how to feed the slot, how to build a patch, how to feed it, how to feed waveguide, how to make a waveguide to coax adapter, and so on. There's a whole bunch of rules of thumb with a mental image as to what's going on inside that give you a hell of a lot more information than the equations. So the way we teach it, in general, does not give useful engineering information in the real world. You need something like 10 years of apprenticeship at a good antenna engineering department to be a good antenna engineer. That's an opinion. Not everybody's going to agree with that. Almost no electronic engineer walks out of a good electrical engineering school with the ability to design antennas. You ask any electronic engineer who favors RF engineering, what is his least favorite course? A high percentage of them will say that damn fields and waves course, those Maxwell's equation course. That's the course that gave me the greatest amount of trouble. It was a big chunk of memorization of matrix equations. Let me drop this. And I passed the test by feeding back those memorized equations. I didn't know what in the world was really happening. I couldn't get a mental picture of what's really going on in the real world. That's the way many electronic engineers walk out of the school, and therefore they spend the rest of their career being scared to death of antennas. They know that it's some kind of black magic, it's got a whole lot of hairy equations, and it's hard to understand, and they avoid it. It doesn't have to be that way. Okay, I think it's time a long time ago, we should have been going over to Roy, AC2GS. Roy, I know you got a whole lot of subjects you'd like to talk about tonight. Choose one. Or maybe have somebody vote on them. The choice is yours. AC2IS, about to give us physics and science report number 24. You've got it, Roy. K2LIW in the tech net.
Thank you very much, Dick, and hello, Dick, and hello, Paul, and hello, everyone out there. I just want to mention once again that if anyone wants to contact me and give me a topic or a suggestion, the email address should be mailbag@ac2gs.com. We actually got one piece of email this week. It was from WA2VDH, John, and he had a very interesting question for us. He remarked that he had heard lightning in a very strange way. It was called brontophonic sounds, and they're originating from all kinds of things. They are known to originate rarely, but they do originate from lightning thunder. They originate from meteorites as they fall into the Earth's atmosphere, and have been known to occur I forget exactly what the hell it is. The ionosphere on the North and the South Pole, the Borealis. The problem with these... Let me drop for a second. I just thought of an aurora. The problem with these things, though, is the time sequence. As we all know, that you can pretty much figure out how far a lightning strike is by counting the number of seconds after you see the flash, waiting for the thunder, and you figure about 1,000 feet per second, and that gives you a very nice approximation for how far the lightning is. The weird thing about brontophonic sounds is that they are almost instantaneous. So I throw it out to the audience if they have a good explanation why brontophonic sounds don't have the usual delay. Is there something strange going on with the speed of sound? I'll throw it out to the audience.
I've got a guess on this one, Roy. The average lightning bolt has thousands of amperes that flow for some number of microseconds through a chunk of air that has been previously ionized by the leader strokes. So you have in the last microsecond, a path between the cloud and the ground has been formed. Thousands of amperes flow through that path. The actual current is flowing through something that's a fraction of an inch in diameter, but that chunk of ionized air gets heated to thousands of degrees Fahrenheit. Air has a very strong positive temperature coefficient. As air gets heated, it expands violently. So that violently expanding chunk of air along that ionized path with thousands of amperes flowing, that generates the sound that we call thunder. That sound then through air, in my belief, is propagating 1,000 feet per second. Is that the right number? Yeah, roughly 1,000 feet per second. So for that sound to go through air any faster than that, I don't think it can do it. However, I can think of the possibility that the current is so violent through that ionized path that that local E field, that local magnetic field, excites some other arcing at some other location. Now, that other arcing can be at the speed of light, 300 meters, 300 million meters per second. So that arc, that simultaneous arc that could occur a fraction of a mile away, that could be a separate sound generator. And if I'm near that second arc, I will hear that local sound. At the same time, I'm seeing the flash of the major strike a mile away.
Repeater, timeout.
I'm looking at the major strike. I'm seeing the light of the major strike. And there is a secondary strike behind me, so to speak, a small number of feet away from me. And I'm hearing that sound. And therefore, to me, it appears as though the sound propagated through that a mile, instead of taking 5 seconds, it only took a few milliseconds. So it could be a perception of a secondary electronic event. That's a pure guess on my part. But for the sound itself to propagate much faster than the speed of sound, 1,000 feet per second, rough number, I'm having great trouble with that. There is a slight variation now as a function of instantaneous pressure. The leading edge of an airplane flying at above the speed of sound has a higher pressure. The trailing edge has a lower pressure. When you're X number of miles away from an aircraft flying above the speed of sound, you don't hear one bump, one bang. You hear ba-doom. In other words, one of those high-pressure sounds propagates a little bit faster than the low-pressure sound. Therefore, you hear two slightly separated sounds. But overall, that whole event to you is 5 seconds per mile the sound has to propagate. AC2GS, K2IZ, go ahead, Roy. That's a bunch of guesses.
VDH with a comment? DH, go ahead.
Yeah, this sound that I would hear, it would always sound like a metallic click that would seem to be coming from somewhere behind me. And as I say, it was always synchronous with the flash of light. This building that I would always see get struck, if you've ever taken the Long Island Railroad into Jamaica, it's just past the St. Albans Station. It's a building, it looks like that movie Kronos, if you ever saw it back in the 50s. It looks just like Kronos. It's a very tall building, and it has a lot of structures on the roof, and I used to watch it get struck regularly. Okay.
Well, I mean, the beauty of this kind of conversation is that we can all be right or wrong, and no one knows, because no one knows the absolute fact of what's causing it. So it's a good source for a lot of theories. And, you know, the more I kind of research lightning and thunder, the more it sort of amazed me. I mean, the language itself, the word for thunder goes back to Proto-Indo-European. It's 4500 BCE. So it's a long, long time ago. I mean, it gave us the word for the Norse god Thor. It gave us the name of Thursday. You know, every Thursday is Thor's day, and Thor was the god of lightning and thunder. But getting back to the thunder and such, I would think that if this was a secondary arcing, people would be able to visualize the arcing and the light produced from it, but I don't think anyone's really seen a secondary spark from reported cases of brontophonic phenomena.
In my shack, from time to time, I've heard a snapping sound when a lightning bolt is a mile or two away from me. I hear a snapping sound, I see a flash out the window, and X number of seconds later, I hear the real thunder hitting me. So I have experienced secondary effects from my antenna system in my shack. I bet you there are other hams have experienced that one. Now, Roy, go ahead.
Okay, that's possible, but you're kind of chicken and the egg type of a thing. The most popular rationale that I've read about is that lightning produces a lot of RF from across the spectrum, from microwave all the way to X-ray. And they actually did an experiment in 1961. They took a transmitter that was tuned to 1,310 megahertz, and they exposed some poor people to 400 microwatts per square centimeter, and they actually created noise in these guys' heads. So RF can produce noise in people's heads, and local steel structures can operate as local antennas and pick up RF generated by lightning strikes and create odd local audio signals from them. It's sort of like the stories of guys with fillings that could listen to AM radio broadcasts.
Oh, you hit a beautiful on that one, Joy. One of the guys who worked for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, Dr. Eugene Frubini, a fairly famous guy who eventually worked for the Department of Defense after he left AIL. But he had an article in the AIL monthly newspaper about an experiment that he personally did. L-band radar, he put his head near the feed horn of an L-band radar, and he heard in his head a buzzing sound at the radar rep rate. There have been articles in the IEEE Proceedings, in the Microwave Theory and Techniques Society monthly journal, which explain this. Let me drop this. I'm not sure of the exact words they use, but I would call it the RF acoustic effect. When the amount of RF energy on pulses, and by the way, because the pulses had an average power that was low enough, it wasn't creating a radio frequency biohazard. So these pulses were megawatt pulses. He's putting his head near the feed horn, but they were brief pulses, only a few microseconds, and a couple of hundred pulses per second was the rip rate. The explanation that was in Microwave Theory and Techniques is that the RF energy gets focused by the dielectric characteristics of a human brain. It gets focused toward the center of the brain, and there you get a very small amount of local heating. Brain material has a very high positive temperature coefficient. You heat up brain material, it expands. So therefore, the pulse of energy being focused at the center of the brain creates a very small P wave, pressure wave of expansion, which spreads outward to the cranium. Since the hearing system is inside of that cranium, you hear that acoustic sound. So that is one of the explanations for why the RF pulsing, clicking sound effect is sensed by human beings. But it requires a pretty strong amount of RF to do that. And you better be doing it with brief pulses so as not to run into a biohazard problem. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Gosh, I hope this isn't the ultimate explanation, because that sounds a little bit too much like cooking one's brain. I mean, I don't think anyone has figured out completely what's causing it. I mean, the study that I just cite goes all the way back to 1961. There's a paper in Richard Feynman gave a course on first-year physics back in the 60s that had a chapter on lightning. And they did a very nice YouTube just the other day. Great minds think alike, I guess. So if you type in lightning.ac2gs.com, bring you to a YouTube of a professor in Great Britain who kind of discourses on the fact that lightning and thunder has been to mankind for so long, and we really know very little about it. We have some theories, but no proof. But, my best guess is the RF, and the reason why we can hear it, I think sometimes it has something to do with getting inside our head, but I think other times, especially I think in John's case, it was simply that large steel skeleton of the building was just acting as a RF antenna and rectifying it locally.
Now, that's a good guess, Roy, and that might be right. And let me ease your fear about cooking one's brain. The human hearing system, the threshold of sound that you can just barely hear, the amount of motion of your eardrum, we're talking about atomic scale. I bet you the eardrum is only moving the dimension of a proton, if you know what I mean, something very, very small. So therefore, the amount of P wave required in the center of your head to go directly to the outer cranium and be picked up by the hearing system, the amount of motion is so small that the amount of heating that RF created could have been a millidegree Fahrenheit, if you know what I mean. Very little is required, because the human hearing system requires an extremely small amount of motion to be above threshold. So the signals that will give you the RF acoustic effect are way below the areas of 10 milliwatts per square centimeter that used to be considered potentially dangerous. And by the way, this is the thermal effect. Let me drop it. For all of the years of the American National Standard Institute ANSI report, the C95 report, radio frequency biohazard, they've been looking for the non-thermal effects of RF energy. Can't find it. Good common sense would lead you to believe that the RF energy has got an E field, and the nerves are picking up the E field, and the signal travels along your nerves, and the brain senses it. People have been looking for that. They've never found it. Thermal effects you can measure. Non-thermal effects they haven't found. And so this acoustics of the radar pulses is thermal in origin, which becomes acoustic because of the positive expansion of a very small amount. The actual amount of energy going to the center of the brain is probably a microwatt is only required to be above threshold. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm probably being overcautious. I don't think the displacement, though, is a fraction of a diameter of a proton. That seems much too small for a biological system. You have to realize that our auditory canal has